Support for WERU comes from Village Soup and the Republican Journal, providing the communities of Waldo, Knox, and Hancock counties with news, information, ideas, events, goods, and services. On newsstands Thursdays and on the web at waldo.villagesoup.com.
How does WERU get so much great music on the airwaves? How does it offer so many diverse programs? By having 100 dedicated volunteer DJs on the air, that's how. We provide training and coaching for people with and without radio experience, people who have a love of music and a desire to share it with others. It's a really fun and rewarding way to serve the community. To learn more, visit WERU.org and click the volunteer button or email us at info@WERU.org. You can also call 469-6600. Maybe you'll be the next new DJ at WERU.
This is WERU FM 89.9 Blue Hill and on the web at WERU.org.
Support for WERU comes from our listeners and from Eric Hopkins Gallery at 120 Tilson Avenue on Rockland's Lower East Side, by Journeys End Marina and the Coast Guard Station. Open most Saturdays 1 to 5 and by appointment, chance, and event. EricHopkinsGallery.com.
It's about 15 seconds before 10 o'clock bookworm time, and time enough to tell you it's 25 degrees outside and sunny. We've hit the high for the day, mostly cloudy tonight and 18, and we're looking at a kind of a messy Friday. 20% chance of rain later on, slight showers and rain likely in the evening. Bookworm!
Good morning and welcome to Bookworm on WERU. My name is Brooke Minner. I am the librarian at the Brooksville Free Public Library, and it is my pleasure to host this monthly show where we talk with Maine authors about books and writing and sometimes all kinds of other topics as well. We have a full house in the studio this morning. Really appreciate all of you being here. I am joined today by four writers, children's book authors, and in one case, a representative of a wonderful, beloved Maine children's book author. In the studio with me today are Gail Donovan, Gail Page, Rachel Walls, and Cheryl Crowder. We are going to go around, do some introductions. Each person is going to do a short reading from the book, and then we will start talking about children's literature, which is one of my absolute favorite topics. So Gail Donovan has come up from the Portland area. Thank you for making the drive.
Good morning.
Is the author of the recently published Finchosaurus, which is the story of Atticus Finch, a 10-year-old wannabe paleontologist. It recently won a Moonbeam Award, which is an award for small presses. And Gail also works as an interlibrary loan librarian at the Portland Public Library, something that kind of makes my heart soar. So Gail, thank you for being here. And we'd love for you to introduce the book and do a short reading.
All right, thank you for having me. And I guess I took the day off from my job in the interlibrary loan department of Portland Public Library, so for a good cause to be here. So I'm going to read from the opening of Finchosaurus. Finch is a dinosaur crazy kid, and he's always digging. And so this scene is where he's been asked to bring in something for their new unit in school, which the unit's called Digging Deep. So he dug up a worm, which he's really disappointed about. He wished he could have dug up a dinosaur fossil. So here we go. Finch was only bouncing a little on his chair, which was actually a giant bouncy ball that Mrs. Davison, the occupational therapist, gave him because he had so much trouble sitting still on a regular chair. But somehow he bounced the worm and all the dirt right out of the bag. Mrs. Adler, he called. Mrs. Adler, I dropped my worm. Kids scrambled for a look, laughing and shouting and crowding in. Broccoli, said Mrs. Adler. Broccoli was Mrs. Adler's special code word. It meant everybody was supposed to stop doing whatever it was they were doing, then back off, step away. Kids began backing away from Finch and the worm, while Mrs. Adler padded slowly across the room like she was a gigantosaurus, and the kids were just some microceratops, too small to worry about. Mrs. Adler looked down at Finch. She looked at the worm. She looked at the dirt spread all over the floor. She shook her head as if she had known all along the bouncy ball was a bad idea, and now she had proof. Then she told Finch that she would call the janitor to clean up the dirt and that he should go outside and put the worm in the class garden. 5 minutes later, Finch was outside. The playground was empty because nobody was at recess. The sky was an empty, no-cloud blue. He didn't want to leave the worm on top of the ground, so he set down the bag and started digging. Then he saw something white in the brown dirt. What was it? A tiny piece of paper. Not a scrap, but a big piece, folded and folded until it was as small as his thumb. Finch unfolded and unfolded until it was flat, and he could read what was written on it. A single word. Help.
Ah, that's so, that's wonderful. That's very compelling.
Thus ends the first chapter.
Yeah. Perfect. So it's kind of a middle grade novel, which has been mostly the focus of your work, it sounds
yes,
like.
Yes, yes.
Perfect. Yeah. Great. So also joined this morning by Gail Page, who is an author and illustrator living locally here in Brooksville. She has written Bobo and the New Neighbor, How to Be a Good Dog, How to Be a Good Cat, and makes wonderful, beautiful, brightly colored paintings and illustrations. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Brooke. Good morning.
Great. Good morning. So Gail's books are picture books, so a slightly different thing to read over the air since they have a heavily visual component, and this is radio. However, I would love for you to set up the book and do a little reading.
Okay, so Bobo and the New Neighbor is my second book out of a series of a book about Bobo. Bobo's the main character, who's a big, goofy dog, who's sometimes clumsy and almost always gets himself into trouble. So Bobo lives with Mrs. Birdhead and Cat, and they're getting a new neighbor. A new neighbor has moved in, and so this is sort of in the middle of the book. "How nice to meet you, Mrs. Wrinkle Rump," said Mrs. Birdhead. "Please come in." Bobo was going to tell Mrs. Birdhead that he wasn't the new neighbor. He was actually covered with the laundry. He had just been told to go get out of the kitchen because he was making a mess and go out and get the laundry. And he didn't know how to bring it in other than covering himself with all the laundry. So he was going to tell Mrs. Birdhead that he wasn't the new neighbor, but then he smelled the muffins. "I'll go get the tea," said Mrs. Birdhead. "Please help yourself to a muffin." So Bobo did. Cat was suspicious. The new neighbor had an enormous appetite. The new neighbor had floppy ears and furry paws and a big black nose. The new neighbor was an imposter.
That's great. Thank you so much. The drawings are so fun. I love Bobo, and I sort of miss the days of reading those books to my daughter. I guess I still could. So also joined this morning by Charlotte Crowder, who also happens to be a Brooksville resident. Brooksville is a hotbed of children's literature and creativity. Charlotte has a newly published book, just came out earlier this year, called A Fine Orange Bucket. It was illustrated by another person with local ties, a woman named Jill Finson, who is hopefully going to join us by phone later on this morning. Charlotte is a medical writer and editor by day, but also writes fiction for children and adults. Her stories have appeared in lots of different publications in Maine and elsewhere. A Fine Orange Bucket is a really fun book. We had a wonderful book launch event at the Brooksville Library this summer that might have been our most heavily attended library event over the last couple years. It was great. So, Charlotte, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity. So I'm going to read the opening of A Fine Orange Bucket. It's very much of a Maine story. Once a year, Percy Stone took a trip to the Hamilton Marine spring sale. The parking lot was full to bursting. Parked pickup trucks lined both sides of Route 1 as far as he could see. Inside, it was like a carnival. There were balloons and streamers, door prizes and raffles. Fishermen and sailors stood six deep, lined up at the cash register, everybody smiling. Percy needed all sorts of things: pot warp to tie his lobster buoys to the traps, new yellow fowlies to keep dry because his old ones leaked, shackles and turnbuckles, the hardware he never seemed to have when he needed it, engine oil for the Jenny Ann. Percy moved his big shoulders through the crowd toward the rack of fowlies, and then he saw the bucket, a fine bucket. Now, Percy already had a serviceable bucket, but this one was bright orange. His own bucket was ordinary. This one was big, perfect for sloshing the decks of the Jenny Ann. He bought it.
That's great. Thank you. And, of course, also a picture book, and Jill's paintings are bright and really, really beautiful. And so certainly we will encourage our listeners to seek out copies of these books so that they can see the artwork. And finally, this morning, we are joined by Rachel Walls. Rachel owns Rachel Walls Fine Art down in the southern part of the state and represents the estate of Dolly Ipgar, one of my very favorite Maine illustrators and authors. We'll hear much more about Dolly's work. You're probably familiar, but she's known for her colorful paintings of animals, did a lot of other kinds of art as well. And what I did not know but learned in researching the show was that she also had painted some very large-scale murals throughout the country. Rachel has recently worked to republish Bug City, one of Ipgar's books that's been out of print since 1975. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Great. So, yeah, tell us a little bit about Dolive and set up the book, and then we will hear a little bit of it.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, Bug City was originally released in 1975 and re-released this July through North Atlantic Books. And an exciting aspect of this re-release of Bug City has been making the book accessible to a wider audience of young readers by distribution through Penguin Random House and partnering with First Book out of Washington, D.C., an organization that believes education is the best way out of poverty for children. And one of the things that Dolive said about this book about a decade ago, before it was re-released, was that in both her painting and her writing, she liked to create worlds of imagination. She liked to transform ordinary reality into a reality that has special meaning. And she said that this book was actually based on her parents' home at 276 Hick Street in Brooklyn. And Bug City actually invites the reader to follow a whimsical day in the life of a Bug City family with Dolive's imaginative illustrations of real insects. The mama is a ladybug, the papa is a daddy long legs, and one of the things that's really great about this book is it actually teaches the reader how to identify a wide variety of actual bugs. So I will read just the beginning of the book and a couple excerpts so you can get an idea of how she does that. In Bug City, in the land of bugs, there is a bug family that lives in a little bug house. Papa Bug is a daddy long legs. Mama Bug is a ladybug. And there are lots of baby bugs. Papa works with a crew of carpenter ants. They are building a bug house. He uses a measuring worm and a sawfly and a wood borer. Mama takes care of the bug children and cleans the bug house. She makes up the bed bugs and sweeps the carpet beetles. She and Papa go to the drugstore to buy some pill bugs. There are blue bottle and green bottle flies in the window. Then they stop at the bookshop to order a new atlas moth and look at the latest bookworms. At the department store, they shop for clothes moths. They look at flannel, silk, and calico moths and at velvet ants, but they don't find any they like. Instead, they pick out a yellow jacket and a walking stick for Papa, and they buy some lace wings to make new curtains for the bug house.
That's great. Thank you. This is really fun, I have to tell you. Being able to hear from you all reading children's books and have this time to talk about them is a wonderful treat for me. So thank you all for being here. If you're just tuning in, this is Bookworm on WERU. My name is Brooke Minner, joined by four guests in the studio today: Rachel Walls, Gail Donovan, Charlotte Crowder, and Gail Page. And we are talking about children's books. So I'm interested to hear from you all. What got you initially interested in writing for children, or Rachel, in your case, Dolive? I think all of you, including Dolive, have also written for adults, either books or essays, other kinds of forms of writing. But I think that children's literature is just such an interesting and rich genre. So curious how that happened for you. Who would like to start?
I'll go.
Yeah,
great. So this is Gail Page. And I started when I moved to Maine in my early 20s, back in 1973. And I needed more trees around me. And so, and being in Maine, it was in October when we moved here, and it was pretty quiet. And so I had plenty of time to do something creative. And I started my first children's book, which was called Oz Tree. And it was about a tree that was different from any other tree in the forest. Well, I sent it out. I went to the library and got the writer's almanac and started sending it out to every publishing company that would accept unsolicited manuscripts, and ended up collecting a lot of rejection slips. In fact, one of my friends suggested that I wallpaper the inside of my outhouse with rejection slips. I never did. I think I had enough, but I never did. But I'm sure there is somebody in Maine who has an outhouse that's wallpapered with rejection slips. So I think having the time to myself and being so inspired by Maine and nature was what got me started.
That's great. And I do like the suggestion of the outhouse.
This is Charlotte. Yes. Charlotte Crowder. I started writing children's books when my children were small. It seemed like all of their adventures would spur my imagination. And I, too, collected a large batch of rejection letters.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So even though you had small children at home, you made time and found the time to write.
I would write while they were in nursery school. Mm-hmm.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Great. How about you, Gail?
Okay. I think we have four introverts here, not wanting to interrupt each other. So yes, I have perhaps similar story to Charlotte. I had always been writing, but when my kids were born, I rediscovered children's literature and, you know, the literature that I had fallen in love with and had made me want to be a writer in the first place. So I had such a great time rereading to my kids childhood favorites, you know, Little Women, Stuart Little, All of a Kind Family, and then reading all the work that was out at that period. Andrew Clements, for example, who just passed away, I think last week, was a favorite of mine to read to my children. And I decided to start that I would try to write a book for kids. And I quickly found that I had so much more sort of respect for the reader as a child, especially reading to my own daughter and really understanding how important it was to end every chapter or even every page on, you know, please, just one more. Please, can we have one more chapter? And so I think it was that experience of reading with my kids that really turned me into the writer that could write something that could be published. So that was great.
It's such a nice description of that sort of nighttime, or I picture it because that's how it is in my house, is sort of nighttime reading and really need to be going to bed, but they just want one more, which is a hard thing to say no to.
I know. It's a powerful force.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great. Okay, Rachel, how about you? Tell us more about Dolive.
So in the 1930s, Dolive's goal was to actually become a writer and illustrator. And unfortunately, like the rest of the ladies around this table, she experienced nothing but rejection notices for the writing that she submitted. And she instead became an art teacher in Manhattan. And in 1939, she was actually the first woman to have a solo show at the Museum of Modern Art. And she was also, and still is, the youngest artist to date to show in a solo show at MoMA. And it was through that exposure, which was also the opening of the education department at the Museum of Modern Art, which is the first museum, not just in the United States, but worldwide, that actually had an education department. A lot of people don't realize that before the 1940s, women, children, people of color, people of lower classes, and by that I mean middle classes, were not invited into public places like museums and libraries. So Dolev really felt that the best way to deliver the art and the books that were in those institutions to children and to the public at large was to do picture books. And so she, in 1945, finally was invited to illustrate for Margaret Wise Brown. And Margaret Wise Brown, as we all know, is a very revered children's book author. And she worked, Dolev did, under Margaret Wise Brown and Dr. Spock and Evelyn Beyer to be trained as a children's book author who could deal specifically with child development issues and to create books which children could learn from. And her first publisher, who she primarily illustrated for, in 1948 gave her her first opportunity to write and illustrate her first book, which was called Animal Hide and Seek. And so after that, she only did one more book for this company where she was an illustrator before she finally got her first opportunity with Doubleday to write and illustrate her first book for them, which was One Horse Farm, which went on to become not only an award-winning book, but the first edition stayed in print for over 30 years. So it was, in fact, very well received.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. She seems just like a completely fascinating character. Someday maybe we'll just have a whole show about her, because I'm a huge fan of her work. So I'm curious, and you've touched on this maybe a little bit in your own ways, but since you are all writers and have had experience in writing for both children and adults, I'm sort of curious what you think the difference is in process, if anything, because as a reader, I'm often, well, I'll just say sometimes as a reader, I feel like the time and attention that is given to children's books is profound in a way that is, you know, holding children in a sort of important and precious way. Maybe you don't feel that way as a writer, but I'm curious if you have done writing for both, if there's a difference for you in the process itself, if it feels different. Anyone?
What a great question. This is Gail Donovan here. Yes, I have written for both, and I think the process, my answer speaks to what I said before about really, really trying to be inside the point of view of the character. And I'm not sure why I was more able to do that with children's characters than with adult. But So I think when you find the age that you want to write for, the voice just comes in. Mm-hmm. I don't think my process in terms of sitting down and writing is that different, but there's something about the empathy that was there for me with kids. And I remember, so the first acceptance that I did get for my first novel that was published, the editor had a note about how she really gets inside, so we really know what it's like to be that kid. And that's always what I'm striving for, is the idea that somebody will be reading it and will have the feeling, oh, somebody really knows what it's like to be me. So that's what I'm, that's what I'm trying to do.
That's great. Yeah. I really appreciate that.
I'm not sure if that answers your question.
It completely answers my question, because I get that feeling often as a reader. Mm-hmm. What about you, Charlotte?
I really don't feel like there's a difference. As a medical writer, I'm trained in the concepts of plain language.
And I think that in all of my writing for adults and my writing for my fiction writing for adults and my writing for children, I'm striving for clarity, and I just love playing with the words
And when you say, I don't think I exactly know what a medical writer is. I mean, I can make some assumptions, but will you just say what that is?
I write medical information for lay audiences, explaining medical things in terms that are understandable. I also write much more complex medical things, but often I'm editing the work of clinicians, and that again, I'm striving for clarity. Uh-huh. And I find that the same tools of making things understandable are useful even in that case.
Yeah, no, that's great. I appreciate that. Gail?
So my experience is a little different because I'm also the illustrator, and the books that I've written for children are picture books. And so I have the ability to show a lot through the pictures, which is great and it's helpful, but then it also means that my words have to be, there are so few words that they have to be powerful. And I have to capture the essence of what I want to say in very few words, unlike writing for adults. But my experience with writing for adults is that I think my experience with illustrating a picture book gives me sort of more abilities to bring out details. Mm-hmm. So because there's no pictures, I feel like in my mind, at least, I want to express details.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. That's really interesting. What about you, Rachel? What do you think for Dolev's work? Obviously hard to put words in her mouth, but...
Well, no, we actually did discuss this a little bit on several occasions, because a lot of people are not aware that she actually wrote several books for adults and also young adults. And like Gail was just mentioning, the books that she's written for older audiences still do have some drawings and illustrations, but far fewer. And one of the things that she really tried to do with the children's books was to demonstrate through her illustrations and through her words and with very careful word selection a very specific message. And what we see as a difference in the work she did for older audiences is a much darker side of Dolev Ipkar, mm-hmm. which I think a lot of people would be very surprised if they have not read some of these books for older audiences, that there is a divergence from her kind of flamboyant, happy designs and wordplay and puns. And she, in Warlock of Night, she discusses the Vietnam War and equates it to a chess game. And also Nightmare and Foal, which is a collection of short stories. A lot of those stories are very dark and I think not what people would expect, because a lot of them do not have happy endings. There's a lot of violence and a lot of misfortune. And so she very much did have a completely different way of engaging in terms of the material that she was presenting to the audiences. It was not just more sophisticated as the audiences were older, but it was actually more darker and dealt with a lot of subject matters that were much more controversial than the work for the children, which was supposed to be appealing and educational to a wider audience, where these adult fiction and short stories probably appeal to a smaller audience because they are somewhat morose and also political.
That's really interesting. And I was entirely unfamiliar until the lead up to the show that she had written for adults. So I'm eager to seek those books out. Although they sound a little dark, I might wait till spring. So since you are adults, we're talking about adults writing for children. I'm curious if any of you test out your work on children while it's in process. And if so, how do you do that?
This is Gail Donovan here. And I, well, when my kids were young, I was able to use them a little bit, but they're sadly in their 20s now, so they don't want me to reach them anymore. But I do have some sort of go-to teachers that sometimes I can call them up and say, I have a manuscript, can I come in? And what I love to do is if I can make it work is read the whole thing aloud and really get the really get that feedback of, do I have them? Do I have them now? Do I still have them? And you can just feel when you do or don't still have their attention. But even if I can't do that for the whole manuscript, I do a lot of reading aloud. And I think, like Gail Page was talking about, you know, economy of word. I think it would behoove all of us. I mean, I think we have to do that as children's writers, but all writers need to really think about every single word. Do I really need that word? And is that really the best word? And, you know, I love to look at all my verbs and think, you know, is that the strongest verb that I can use right there? So, yes, I like to read my work aloud, especially if I can get a audience of young people to help with that.
Mm-hmm. And when you go into classrooms like that, do you, beyond just sort of getting the feel of, are the kids with you, do you ask them specifically for feedback? Because I could imagine that could be interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
That's great. That's great. What about you, Gail Page?
So I don't have a ready audience of young people, but I am in a great writing group.
Oh, great.
And so I can read anything to them. And I could, even if they're trying to be polite, I could tell by the looks on their faces whether I've lost them or they think it's a weird idea. So that's very helpful. And in the past, I've also have had great editors. Mm-hmm. So that's been really helpful.
Have you been with the same writing group for a long time?
I have, yeah, for years.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I've had many authors come on the show over the years who have had long-standing connections with a writing group that have been really important to them. So that's great. What about you, Charlotte?
I used my children when they were young, and I also had a very active children's book writers group at that time, and now I have a writers group that's more focused on adult fiction, but I do run my children's stories by them as well.
Okay, that's great. So was here in Maine, you found a writing group that was specific to children's literature?
That was actually not in Maine.
Okay. I was going to say, that's impressive, and I've never heard of that. Okay, well, fair enough. Okay, yeah, Rachel, what about Dolly? Was she able to test her work out on children?
She actually tested her work out on her own children. Mm-hmm. She has two sons, Bob and Charlie, and they were not only the testers of her literature, but they were often the inspiration. A lot of the books that she wrote were either based on ideas that they gave her or things that they asked her to write about. And so that has been through, you know, the 40s and 50s been a lot of the inspiration for Dolov's books. She was also given some direction by her publishers at Doubleday about things that they'd like her to discuss in her books. And then now for me, one of the things that I've been doing as I've been trying to figure out which books will put back into print is I do a lot of outreach at Rachel Walls Fine Art, both in the physical building of Rachel Walls Fine Art, but also in schools and at the Portland Public Library. A couple years ago, there was an illustration show of Dolov's. And so I take opportunities when I have access to either elementary school children, high school children, or middle school children, and even adult groups to do readings of the out-of-print books that a lot of them are not familiar with to see how they respond. And one of the things that I personally do is I start off with the books that have been award-winning, like Bug City was award-winning in the 70s, and I first test those and then see how they respond. And then there are some other titles that did not win awards that I personally like, and so I test those too. And that's been really my method of trying how to figure out which titles will be most appropriate to try and bring back into print and get some gauge on how popular and well-received they might be.
That's great.
I have a question for Rachel, if I may. What sort of topics was her publisher asking her to write about, and how did that differ from the things her kids were asking her to write about? And do you feel a difference in those books, or which do you have ones that you prefer? Or,
well, for instance, like her book called The Wonderful Egg, which is a book about dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. That was a request by one of her sons. He wanted a book about dinosaurs. And
good topic.
It's a great topic. And it's a wonderful book for those of you who haven't read The Wonderful Egg. But if you look at most of the other books in the 40s and 50s that she was writing at that time, they're mostly about farm life and really things that were relevant to American society in the 40s and 50s, and promoted that kind of, family unity, and also like One Horse Farm, really in a lot of ways is a reflection of automation. And so she was using these topics to kind of discuss in a way that children could relate to bigger issues in society. And so I would say that a book like The Wonderful Egg is a departure from that, because instead it's really about dinosaurs, which were not, in that train at all. But she did take that opportunity to actually use it as a teaching moment about dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. So it was divergent from what the publishers were kind of looking for, because it wasn't as mainstream. But it was something that was educational and also interesting. And the pictures in the book are beautiful. And so it really appealed to the publishers.
That's really great. If you're just tuning in, this is Bookworm on WERU. My name is Brooke Minner. I am the librarian at the Brooksville Free Public Library, and I'm joined by four guests this morning: Rachel Walls, Gail Donovan, Charlotte Crowder, and Gail Page. We're talking about children's literature and illustrations. So I'd like to shift just a little bit and talk about the current publishing world for children's books. It's always something that I'm interested to hear from my guests because, as has already been noted, it is very difficult to get one book published, much less more than one, and it's a kind of rapidly shifting landscape. So if any of you would be willing to kind of talk about what that process has been like for you, I think that there are lots of aspiring writers out there who would be interested to know. How did you do it?
Silence. This is Gail Page. So I have a series of three books, and they're all published by Bloomsbury, and they're focused on the main character, Bobo. And I'm finding it difficult now to get a fourth one published. And I think three seems to be the magic number. I mean, if they want three books, and if I think if they do very well financially for the publishing company, then they'll take on a fourth. If not, if they're a little dubious about it, then they leave you hanging. And it's and I've also been told that no other publishing company would be terribly interested in publishing further books, because then there's some royalty rights and also they're thinking, well, why doesn't Bloomsbury want to keep publishing So, and the books are doing fairly well. One is out of print, but the others are doing pretty well. But still, I think it's not good enough for Bloomsbury to keep publishing. So I am thinking I want to keep Bobo and his family, Mrs. Burdett and Cat, alive. I like them, and I know that there are a lot of little fans out there who still like them. And so if I have to self-publish, it's something that I would explore.
That's really interesting. Thank you.
That's an interesting coincidence. I think the three is the magic number of I had three novels published with a big place, and then I needed to find a new publisher, I guess for the same reasons. But I had such a wonderful experience with Islandport Press, and you know, you often hear. And it turned out to be true for me. You know, you have a closer relationship with your editor. You have a lot more input. You have a lot more control. And so, you know, that is an option for people. And right there's so many options now. I mean, if you're, you know, there are the big houses and there are the small presses, and there's all kinds of self-publishing options. So I think people do have a lot of paths that they can try for publication, but you know, just I would say persistence is the word.
Yeah,
it can take a long time.
And when you made that move from the bigger publishing house to Islandport, did you have an agent or someone who was assisting you in that, or how did you?
I did have an agent, but I was also really lucky in that the editor at that time at Islandport. Knew my work and had said to me over the years, I'd love to work with you someday. So that was kind of an easy, easy path for me. And then it turned out to be, it was a great experience, and we did Finchosaurus, and I was happy it won a Moonbeam. So, and funny, it was in the category of preteen mystery, which I hadn't thought of it as a mystery, but it does have a mystery element, so that was really great.
That's great. What about you, Charlotte? And actually, it's funny because I remember a few years ago you and I talking about this at the library.
Yes, that's true. Well, after years and years of those rejection letters, I was quite lucky with the Fine Orange Bucket. North Country Press out of Unity, Maine, accepted it on the first run, and again, that's a small press. And I had a wonderful experience. It was really very, very, very positive.
I'll say too. I mean, as a librarian who buys books for the library, sometimes those small presses, Islandport, others. Are so great because I can look at a catalog that doesn't feel overwhelming and feel like these are sort of a carefully curated selection of books. Whereas, you know, otherwise it's just there's so many books being published all the time, which is wonderful. It feels overwhelming. And so I rely a lot on those kinds of small presses and, you know, the little promo emails that I get, I find it super helpful. So, and Dolive, of course, was publishing in a very different time.
Well, she started publishing over 70 years ago. And so originally she was actually being published at the big publishing houses in New York City. And what happened over the course of her career is that eventually a lot of those books became out of print after decades. And about 10 years ago, Islandport Press revived several titles and put them back into press on a smaller scale and primarily, you know, here in Maine, and then distribution throughout the country and even some places internationally based on demand. And what I found after they had gone through the titles that they were interested in, I kind of did the reverse, actually, of what some of these ladies have done. I then actually went back to the big publishing houses to see if they had any interest in reviving some of the books that they had originally put out decades before by Dolive. And that's where a partnership with an organization like North Atlantic Books, which is actually the publishing arm of an educational not-for-profit, has been really helpful for me in terms of getting Dolov's books to have a wider exposure, because they're larger and they have more resources and they have more collaboration and partnerships on the national level. I've had success in really making a case for the fact that there are educational benefits to some of these books, and that's part of why they won awards in past decades for their educational merits, and have made the case that it would be a good idea to bring these back and see how they've done, how they would do, you know, in this time period as opposed to decades later. And so far, there has been a tremendous response to Bug City. And one of the things that's interesting is that even though it did win awards in the 70s, it was not a great seller in terms of comparison with her other books. And that's because in the 70s, people didn't really embrace bugs the way that we're embracing them now. And well, it was challenging. I mean, I remember, I'm in my 40s, and so growing up, you know, bugs were gross, and a lot of people didn't love bugs. And now one of the things that's changing in society is we are really seeing that bugs are an important part of the ecosystem, and we also see that there are bugs that are disappearing, and we also see that there are some bugs that their populations are getting a lot larger, and they're spreading diseases. So it's, I think, an important time to take advantage of this shift in the way people look at this topic and see that here's an opportunity to not only educate the reader about the bugs and how they look and what they do in a fun way that is non-threatening, but also really kind of, you know, change the way that people look at bugs and allow them a new opportunity to embrace them. And it's been interesting. Part of what really prompted me to push Bug City is the fact that when I would do readings, overwhelmingly, the school children loved Bug City and just thought it was great. And because I wasn't doing this outreach, you know, 4 decades ago, I don't know what the response was, but I speak to a lot of people who are reading this book to their children, and it is interesting how many of them really, you know, discuss the fact that they don't like bugs or didn't like bugs, and so it hadn't occurred to them to, you know, read this to their children. But when they learn that it actually teaches them and it's a great way to help them identify bugs and we change the context in which they're thinking about the book, they have a whole new way of looking at it and are actually embracing the topic.
That's great. I believe we have a caller on the line. Jill, are you there? Maybe not. I think we're having some technical problems. So Jill Finson is the illustrator of A Fine Orange Bucket with Charlotte Crowder, and hopefully we will get her on the line. But in the meantime, yeah, go ahead.
I had I don't know if it's a question or a comment. That's what the kids always say in school. They're so funny. The teacher says, do you have a question or a comment? And many kids have both. But Brooke, something you said about that you appreciate the catalogs of the small presses as a librarian. I was interested in that because since I work at the library, I'm sort of curious about how books are selected for our collections. And I know one of the things that one of the tools that's used are the reviews. And one thing that happens is that the books published from the larger houses get more reviews and from the smaller presses get fewer. So it's great to hear that as a librarian, you don't rely only on that, but that you use the catalogs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do, of course, read reviews from all of the sort of major publications that publish them because I work at a very small library. So it's happening on a very different scale than at Portland Public. I can really take the time and space to go through those smaller catalogs, particularly because we have some that are Maine-based. Mm-hmm. So it's important to me to be able to connect with those
That's
Maine authors.
Great to hear.
And then I take a lot of suggestions from my patrons, you know. Mm-hmm. I discover new books all the time that people come in and, you know, someone told them about or they happen to pick up someplace random. So, I'm really fortunate in that. And Maine has so many wonderful tiny little libraries that we can really take the time to be selective. And all librarians are careful, but I just think it happens in a different way in big libraries. So I like the catalog. So I know they're still working to get Jill on the line, and I'm not sure if I should encourage listeners to call in because of the possible technical problems. Yep, sounds like that's fine. We actually just have about 10 minutes left in the show this morning, but if you would like to call in, we'd love to hear your questions or thoughts about these books or children's literature in general. You can call 469-0500 and we would be happy to put you on the air. So Charlotte, I wanted to ask you, since you wrote a book that was illustrated by someone else as opposed to Gail Page, who's writing and illustrating her own books, or Dolive as well, how did that process work for you? And you know, what was it like collaborating with Jill as an artist?
Well, it was fun. I mean, it's not the traditional way when a larger publisher usually will pick the illustrator, and oftentimes there's very little communication between the writer and the publisher. But this being a small publishing company, I was asked to find the illustrator, and Jill happened to spend summers down the road from me. and I had seen her artwork. She's a very active artist in the area. We had a lot of fun working together on this.
That's great. I think it really shows in the way that her illustrations, you know, play with the words. And yeah, and they're very beautiful. So I'm glad that was a fun process for you. So I would love to hear, as we're kind of entering the last few minutes of the show, what you are all working on now. Writers usually, you know, have a project in their back pocket or a dream project of some sort. So if you'd be willing to share, I'd love to hear it. You want to start, Rachel?
As we touched on earlier, it is important for a publisher to make sure that it is financially viable for them to publish books. So North Atlantic Books and I are waiting, since Bug City just was released in July, to see how well it does. But there are two other books that Dolive has written, in this one in the 60s and one in the 70s, that as long as book sales of Bug City remain as good as they've been so far in the initial months, continue, we will be seeing two more titles of hers that have been out of print for decades coming back in the next year as well.
Oh, that's great. I think we're going to try one more time to get Jill on the line. Are you there, Jill? No. Okay. Technical problems.
Wait. No.
It's live radio. These things happen. Okay, Gail Donovan, how about you? What are you working on?
I'm working on another middle grade novel. This is, I guess, I've landed in the place that I like. And I have a process that's sort of different ingredients will be sort of simmering for a long time. I'll be thinking about things. And so a few of the ingredients are, I had heard about the concept of something called an endling. It's the last, very last creature of a species. And I was trying to think about how to write about that in a way that was realistic fiction. And I wasn't really coming up with the solution. But I was thinking about the last of something. And then for a long time, I'd also been wanting to write about a cat lady. And then I was also thinking about a sort of one of those moments you remember and you cringe, which was where I accidentally broke somebody's leg. And So I was sort of putting all these things together and came up with this character who is a very high-spirited girl who completely by accident breaks the leg of the neighborhood cat lady. And it's sort of everything that follows after that and taking care of the cats. And then, so the book is called The Last Cat. And I'm just chipping away at that. And so we'll see.
That's great. Yeah. It sounds like a fantastic premise. Although I will say, I always cringe a little when librarians start talking about cat ladies because oh, I dear. Do periodically.
How many cats do you have?
Brooke? Yeah, I do not have any cats. I'm allergic, in fact. Yeah. That's great. Charlotte, how about you? What are you working on?
Well, I'm actively working on a adult short stories right now, but I have a whole backlog of probably at least half a dozen picture books and three completed middle grade novels that I'm really trying to find a home for.
Mm, wow, that's great. And I hope that you do. And short stories, I hope that that gets out the door. I'd love to have you back sometime to talk about that. It's one of my favorite adult genres. Mm-hmm. Gail, how about you?
So recently I've been working on adult fiction. The first one, which I finished, and it was it started to be a family memoir based on my grandmother's life. And we had brought my mother to come live with us. And I thought, okay, this is sort of the end of the line as far as getting information about her mother, and then there wasn't enough facts, and so I thought, okay, I'll turn it into a novel. And so I had a great time doing that, and I'm now looking for an agent for that. And I started a second adult novel, and I'm thinking about further stories with Bobo, and have even thought about maybe having a spinoff and featuring Mrs. Birdhead. Maybe not for children, but for 70-year-old women.
That does sound really great. That's fantastic. We really just have a few minutes left in the show, and I'd like to just go around one more time and ask you either what your favorite book was, favorite books as a child, and or what you're reading now and like, or you can probably answer both. But I love to put some book recommendations out at the end of the show, and I've had some really wonderful ones over the years. Rachel, you want to begin?
I personally am reading a book called Tough Love, My Story of Things Worth Fighting For by Susan Rice. And then for a children's book, At One in a Place Called Maine by Lynn Plourd is one of my absolute favorite books that I can't recommend enough for children. And then I also have a obviously personal love for Dolev's books, and Deep Sea Farm I think is a great book. It's a wonderful book that teaches, again, children how to identify fish and sharks and other marine life.
That's
and
great.
Then Action Jackson by Jan Greenberg and Sandra Jordan is a book about Jackson Pollock that I think is really excellent. And then The Piano Starts Here, The Young Art Tatum is a story written and illustrated by Robert Andrew Parker about what it was like for Art Tatum as a young, blind boy to find his way. And as we all know, he went on to become a piano virtuoso, so it is inspiring. So I would recommend those.
That's great. We just have a few minutes left. What about you, Gail?
Well, I'm going to neither a favorite book from childhood nor a book that I'm reading now, but just a book that I want everyone to read because I loved it so much. It's called In Zanesville by Joanne Beard. And the narrator is a 14-year-old girl, and it has such a powerful opening that I can still remember. It says, "We can't believe the house is on fire. It's so embarrassing, first of all, and so dangerous, second of all."
Oh,
also,
that's so great.
There's a sense of we're supposed to be in charge here, so there's a sense of somebody not doing their job. Now, how could you not want to read a book that's the opening paragraph? So
that's
I
fantastic.
Just think everyone might want to pick that up.
Thank
In Zanesville
you.
By Joanne Beard.
Oh, that's great.
It's
Thank you.
Not a children's book, but I love it.
What about you, Gail Page?
So a recently read book entitled On Earth We Are Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong, who is a Vietnamese poet. I highly recommend. I mean, it's so beautifully written. It's very poetic and amazing. And the subject matter is pretty intense and surprising. And I just loved it.
Mm. Sounds wonderful. We just have just about a minute left. What about you, Charlotte?
My favorite book growing up was The Island of the Blue Dolphins. Mm. Unfortunately, I don't remember the author's name. Maybe
Odell,
some...
I think.
Okay.
I think that's true.
It's the story of a young girl left alone on an island with a pack of wild dogs.
Such a fantastic book. Thank you all so much for being here. This has been really fun. Thank you to John Greenman for engineering the show. I will be back in January at a new time, 4 o'clock on the fourth Thursday of the month. More about that soon. Thank you for tuning in to Bookworm on WERU.
Support for WERU comes from Penobscot Bay Press, committed to providing community news and information, publishing 3 weekly newspapers, the Weekly Packet, Island Advantages, and the Castine Patriot, as well as the Bay Community.